Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes.
I'm Rick Tilbert at CPA Trendlines. Thanks for joining us today. Our guest today is Robert Fleeber, founder and CEO of RF Resources, the most active broker for mergers and acquisitions and executive search for accounting firms in the most active market in the world, New York City. What we learn about trends in the business in New York City extend across the country and around the world. Robert, in particular, is probably the best connected person to talk about mergers and acquisitions and executive search in the New York area. Robert, the first question is about private equity. What does private equity mean to the accounting profession?
So Rick, thank you for that introduction. I really appreciate that. And I'm glad that is your first question about private equity, because I think that is the biggest thing going on in the profession, second to one other, which we'll talk about later. But the word that comes to mind most definitely is disruptive. It is probably the most disruptive thing that has happened in the profession in my 35, 40 plus year career. And what I mean by that specifically in a nutshell is it has flipped the model totally on what happens to partners seeking a buyout, and it has flipped the model entirely on ownership, a corporate structure in the accounting firms, coupled with an existing major, major staffing problem. So disruptive is probably putting it a little bit mildly.
How does it affect staffing?
Well, what I know is happening from speaking to people every day, managing partners of all different size firms, and primarily partner and their partner professionals in the accounting firms, is there is a lot more pressure in the firms that have taken private equity, whether it's more hours, more realization, more profitability, reporting to a corporate ownership. I think that has put a lot of pressure on the firms from top to bottom, and will definitely affect the continuing staffing shortage in a not good way, in my opinion.
How does private equity affect not the firms involved in private equity, but the firms that have to compete against the firms involved in private equity? How do you compete against a firm that has taken private equity?
Oh, okay. I don't think it's hard at all. I really do not think it's hard. And I think some firms I know are doing it, which is you can create your own private equity, you know, by a line of credit. If you don't have significant debt on your balance sheet and you're a robust firm and your current and prior history is strong, you can definitely get significant bank financing or third-party financing and compete very effectively with private equity. I know for a fact that several firms are including a very significant cash component in their M&A deals, and they are not private equity. They are just strong firms that have chosen to stay totally independent and provide the financing. And what private equity has done, you didn't ask the question, but I'll answer anyway, is created a liquidity factor. Accounting firms have always been desirous of expanding their advisory services in anything outside of tax and audit. And you cannot buy a good company without putting up some cash. And CPA firms by nature take out their cash. So you need funds to acquire a good company. And that's where private equity has raised the bar and just created a gigantic good awareness of the need for capital to grow. And that's, and it's happening.
Who is private equity? Where do these people come from? What's their background? And why are they interested in the accounting business of all things?
Yeah, now that's a great question. And I've had numerous conversations with private equity firms, and I can't say I'm an utter expert in it, but it's a very interesting population. You know, by and large, it is really, really smart people out of the top schools, generally very young. You know, the founders may be on the older side, perhaps, but it's a very smart, aggressive, analytical group that is very focused on profitability and growth and current and future liquidity events. It's not a CPA firm. It's not that colleaguing and, you know, partner meetings and all that kind of stuff. It's all about return on equity, creating EBITDA, and it's just a very different population, and they are, you know, high ownership in these accounting firms, and that has to have some significant input, and it does. It's day-to-day impact.
Why now? Why is this outside money so interested in the accounting business? Is the accounting business that sexy, that interesting, that profitable, that growth oriented? Why is private equity interested in accounting of all things?
Well, it is a good business. Most people do not realize how profitable CPA firms are in terms of their bottom line profit and the stickiness of the clients, the retention of the clients, and between the profitability and the retention. And it has been described in many cases as recession resistant. So it is an untapped market that for some reason private equity firms woke up to in the past, not just the past year, where it's become much more vocal, but these discussions have been going on for probably 4 or 5 years. And now it's germinating into real deals. You know, it's big firms and even filtering down to, you know, firms that aren't so big. But it's a good business model, accounting firms. It really is. Has been, always will be.
You mentioned recession resistant. What do you think the economy going forward will do to decision making when it comes to private equity? Will it expose some flaws in private equity? Will it accelerate the private equity interest? How does a potentially recessionary environment affect this trend?
Well, the pressure on earnings is going to be very steep as it is. In the private equity is just all about making money, as every other business is, but even maybe more with a sharper edge. And if there is a major recession and there's businesses that are affected really badly in certain industries, and firms go out of business in certain industries, or clients, there's more fee pressure, I think it's just going to increase the pressure on the partners and the staff to figure out a way to make it up, either through business development. We could see, private equity or not, we could see layoffs. We haven't really seen layoffs in the accounting profession, in public accounting profession, in many, many years. If anything, firms are like desperate for people, but that could change. And private equity is going to put more pressure on the firm than they would put on themselves. I mean, that's my feeling.
Private equity will put more pressure on the firms than the firms have been doing. How does private equity change how a CPA firm works?
What they say is that it is business as usual. You run your tax clients or your advisory clients exactly as you always have, setting billing rates, hiring, firing, staffing, you name it, across the board, you run your business exactly as is. What they don't say is, what is the impact of having a new 40% owner that's looking for their share of the profits, and what that means to the existing partner and staff group? That, to me, is the big unknown, and why the jury is very much out, in my view.
When private equity takes over a firm, how does it affect below the partner level, especially senior staffers who are interested in becoming a partner? How does private equity affect staffers?
I think it's in a very subtle way, because, you know, private equity ownership and activities really don't filter down directly to staff and seniors and things like that. But I know for a fact that the partners, the senior partners and the regular non-senior partners, have a lot more pressure on them to produce. There's reporting, there's metrics to be met, more and more above what the firms already did, which was already pretty significant, but good firms have good metrics and good, you know, dashboards and all that kind of stuff. So I think it filters down from the partners to the staff, that the pressure and the pressure to produce more profitability, higher, more hours, higher realization, And you know, staff, as everybody knows, are very, very sensitive to the pressure and the hours. And that's not going to get any better. And private equity only makes it worse.
Private equity makes the hours and pressure worse on staffers. What can staffers do about that? What do you see staffers doing about the increased pressure that private equity brings into a firm?
Well, I think it puts the idea in their minds of making a change. You know, part of the reason there is such a big staffing shortage right now is because the same people exist, the same number of people exist pretty much. It's been around forever in the firm, staff, senior manager, et cetera. But the biggest problem has been, because of the pandemic and other factors, people are not moving, you know, and especially if you're working remote or hybrid, you know, the pressure of going into the office and having to deal with people you may not want to deal with on a day-to-day basis in some cases, that pressure is gone. It's a lot easier, I think, to work remotely than in the office. But external factors can make somebody think differently, that if they're all of a sudden feeling like this firm is not going the direction I want to go, I want to be in a mid-sized firm, I want to be in a more entrepreneurial firm, I want to be in a more, you know, collaborative, you know, traditional culture, then they will probably leave. So that's what's going to happen. It is happening to some extent.
Yeah, it sounds like pressure is building within staff. It's pent up pressure that, given the right opportunity or the right economic conditions, could lead to a whole new round of turnover.
Yeah, it really could. And, you know, it's had an interesting side effect too. I've seen recently, and I hope it's a trend for the future, because I think it's great for the profession. Younger people wanting to go into their own firm, or younger people wanting to break away from their large firm and acquire a small firm or a mid-sized firm because they're entrepreneurial. I haven't seen much of that in all my years recently. There's, you know, easily four or five people I'm working with that want to do that. They want to be the buyout strategy for a smaller firm that has a succession issue. I think that's really positive for the profession.
When people spin out and establish their own practice, or even established firms, what is it about private equity that they can apply to their strategies going forward? Private equity does things differently, thinks different in a different way than traditional CPAs or CPA firms. How is it changing, or how could it change, the long-term idea of CPA firms that may not be interested in private equity, but are gleaning lessons from how private equity operates?
Well, the big message in whether a small or mid-sized firm wants to deal with it or not is question mark, is growth by acquisition. And I'm not talking about acquisition of accounting firms. That's always in the cards of is a growth strategy, and I think it's a wise strategy. But I'm talking about the non-accounting firms, non-attest, non-tax, getting into the advisory businesses. And most smaller to mid-sized firms don't really care that much, to be quite honest. You know, it's great if something fell into their lap, but it's not their core business. And unless they can acquire a company, which is really hard to do, or have an internal champion to start something new, it's not really going to happen. I think the accounting business is strong as it is, and the younger people that want to either buy a firm or start their own firm will probably be, not probably, they are quite happy to be in the traditional business acts, and perhaps financial statement work as well, because, you know, at a high level, they're not looking to do low-level 1040s, obviously, but high-level tax work and tax advisory work is very, very lucrative. I think that's where the real interest is in the young people.
How does private equity affect that hot-button issue of mergers, acquisitions, and the question of succession?
Well, selfishly, Rick, I would say it's been a great help to my business, for sure.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it has really increased the awareness of the need to do something. Even if a smaller to mid-sized firm knows they are not going to qualify for private equity. It's all the buzz. It's got firms thinking more and more, and we really have to do something. We've been sitting on our hands. We know it. We know it. That's enough talk already. More firms are raising their hands saying, we need help. Can you help us? And that's part of my job. And what makes it interesting is trying to come up with creative solutions, whether it's the best fit for that firm to do like a modest merge up, or to bring in younger partners or a team of people to be the succession plan. That's what makes it interesting.
What's your best advice to firms that are not interested in private equity, but are interested in mergers and acquisitions and dealing with their succession strategy?
Okay. Well, what comes to mind, Rick, is may sound a little corny, but the acronym of BYOB. I don't mean bring your own bottle. What I mean is be your own banker. And by that, I mean, if you don't have a lot of debt on your balance sheet, you can definitely get financing. There's, you know, whether it's commercial banks or outside financing companies, they definitely exist. And like I said earlier, it's a really good business. You can get a very good line of credit, and you can use that for M&A acquisitions or, you know, non-CPA firm type of acquisitions. And staff, I mean, everybody knows salaries are going crazy. You need more money to be more competitive in that market too. So you can do it yourself. I really do believe that.
Mergers and acquisitions have only accelerated over the years with a couple of exceptions. Over the next year or two, how much M&A activity do you expect? Do you expect it to be more or less than we're seeing now or we saw before?
I think it's going to be more. I do think there's going to be more mega mergers and more mega private equity deals. Where it all goes, nobody really knows, but the pace of mergers is going to go high. There's very different sweet spots in the market. I think the smaller firms in that 2 to 10 or 2 to $20 million range that have succession issues, they really need a lot of help. And I really enjoy working with firms that size because they can really use the help and appreciate it. And on the other side, there is significant concern about firms below that level, because there's some really good firms out there with specialties and they make good money and they're incredibly nice people. But if a firm doesn't have young partners or young staff or younger staff or partners, no matter how specialized they are and the niches they have and the profitability, they're not of high interest to the firms that are buyers. So that's an ongoing issue out in the profession right now. But to answer your question, the pace of activity is going to continue to be very high.
And what about valuations? Are prices for accounting firms going up, going down, or going sideways?
They're stable, but they have gone down considerably over the past 5 years. I mean, you know, multiples, to use that word, of 1.5 or even more were not unusual 5 or 8 years ago. That really doesn't happen now. But it's really, you know, based on the desire of the firm, what the market commands. And I'm a big believer in blended rates. I mean, a firm may be willing to pay a much higher price for the high net worth tax part of one business and maybe a lot less for the audits and reviews of another practice and or another part of the practice, and come up with something that rewards the selling firm appropriately for their work. And in the right situation, a merger or a merger leading to a buyout, which is more common, should be accretive to the seller as well as the buyer over time. Do additional services, fees going up over time, more resources to be able to do better work, and certainly technology and things like that.
What steps can a firm take to improve its potential valuation?
Well, the really hard things the firms do, all they can do, but probably could do a little bit more, which is building up their infrastructure, building up their team by bringing in more people, more qualified people, more of a farm team type of approach from colleges and interns and things like that. because it really is all about the people. And even the firms that are really good and have all the right things in place, accounting firms really don't do a great job marketing themselves. I don't mean marketing with websites and brochures and all that kind of stuff. I mean, in the M&A process, I think there's a lot to be said for packaging your firm, to use a word, of having everything all together, why the firm is a great firm to consider acquiring or merging with, bios of the people, highlighting the specialties, highlighting the accomplishments, highlighting the relationships. You know, accounting firms didn't get to be so profitable for no reason. The services are needed. But when you think about it, you know, every accounting firm between all their clients has an incredible wealth of information. Of each client has attorneys and bankers and wealth management people, and those relationships can be tapped into in a much more ambitious way than, because most firms just don't have time. They don't have time to cultivate that. So the opportunity is huge, I think, for growth.
For firms that want to increase their valuation, that understand that they need to do these things, but they're also interested in a return on their investment. Is it worth it for the typical accounting firm to make the investment in improving its valuation? And is it worth the wait for the results to come in? In other words, it takes money to put investment into a firm to improve its valuation. It takes time for the returns from that investment to start coming in. Is it worth the time and the money for most firms to do that? Or should they think about selling now while the market is hot?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's worth it if they have enough of the pieces already in place, meaning the people, the finances, the client base, some specialties, profitability. If a lot of those things are lacking, I would say no. They probably should be preparing for a different type of transition, you know, merging up perhaps. It's a tremendous amount of work to do it. And everybody is pretty strapped as it is for time. So, and it's not the core strength of a CPA firm partner to be a great recruiter or a great, you know, not everybody's a great business developer. And nobody, it's a question mark, or do you want to allocate your cash capital to those things that, you know, long-term will work, but short-term, you'll make less money. Big decision to make.
Are you saying that now is a good time to sell?
Yeah. Oh, no. Now is as good a time as any. I think the desire for firms to grow by acquisition and strategic mergers is always very high, as high as it ever has been. And on the seller side, even more so. I think because of the private equity and because of the disruption and everything that's going on in the profession, you can't turn around. And it's exciting. I think it's very exciting with what's going on with artificial intelligence and outsourcing and working on the project basis and value billing. And there's just a lot going on. I'm fascinated personally by things like ChatGPT. And if anybody hasn't, you know, played around with that, you should. It's really eye-opening and a little scary, but it's an exciting time.
You've talked about how a seller can really stand out. What about buyers? How do you become a desirable buyer? What's a desirable buyer look like?
Well, the most desirable buyer is the people that have done successful deals, because they will almost invariably open up the door to a seller saying, you can talk to any one of these 5 or 8 or 20 partners that merged in over the years, and they'll tell you what their process was like and why this is a good firm to merge into. But if you've not done M&A deals as a buyer and you want to do them, then you have to make yourself be more desirable. And I think that's by being very active in the profession, whether it's on the state level or the AICPA level, becoming known in the profession, having the pieces in place that a firm looking to sell would be looking for, which is a robust infrastructure to support growth, an active social media presence, a desirable work location, even though it may be hybrid and never full-time necessarily again, and creating almost like I mentioned before, sort of a black book of, here's why we are a desirable firm to merge with. Here's our partner group, here's our industry niches, here's our external relationships, and here are, 8 bullet points of why we would be a great firm to consider merging with. I think that eliminates the question mark. Well, you haven't done this before. Well, everybody has to start somewhere.
I think you said that the quality of the staff, aside from the quality of the clients and the quality of the relationship a firm has, is a determinative factor in the attractiveness of a firm. What do firms need to know about recruiting and retaining the best talent these days?
Well, I think it's well known by everybody in the profession what the firms are doing that are the most progressive at creating happy staff and retaining staff and being desirable to external candidates, which is all of the family-friendly policies. It's the remote work or the hybrid options. It's the flexible hours. It's benefit packages. And it's, I should mention this at the very beginning, the biggest of all is the work-life balance. And, whether you like it or not, that is really important to younger people. And they will work hard when it's necessary and they'll be responsible for getting the work out the door. But the freedom to do it on their schedule is paramount.
What drives people to leave? Whether you're a partner or a staffer, what are the red flags or signals going on in your firm that should prompt you to start looking elsewhere?
Well, it's a host of things. It can always be the feeling that the staff person does not really like the direction of the firm, whether the firm is just getting too big and further removed from being the collegial old-time partnership meeting environment type of thing. It could be internal relationships, which I think is less and less of an issue because firms of all different sizes have gotten way better about getting rid of, to use that expression, getting rid of bad people, like whether it's partners, managers, or staff that are just difficult. Nobody wants them around. And even if they're big producers or whatever, it's becoming less and less of an issue. What else prompts people to leave? Compensation has become, I think, less of an issue. It's not the number one factor. It's a big challenge now because competing firms are offering a lot more money than people might be making. But most people will just not leave because of money. It's going to be something more intangible than that. Could be career path. It could be getting to more of a specialty area. And a lot of times it really comes down to, it almost always comes down to culture. And one of the big factors is going from bigger firms to smaller is much more common than the other way around because they're looking for a different experience, a more close-knit group, a little more control over their destiny. So that has definitely always been the case and will continue to be, I think.
That's interesting. Yeah, you've indicated that options are narrowing for smaller firms in the $1 to $5 million a year area. Why? Why are options for the smaller firms becoming less?
Well, first of all, there is a shrinking number of buyers just because of the mergers that have happened over the past 10 to 20 years. It's probably got to be 30 or 50% less mid-sized firms now than there were 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So the population of buyers shrinking, and the firms that are active buyers and have done deals or may want to do deals are becoming more and more selective. They really do want the younger quality staff and some younger partners. Firm that has 80% of their partners retiring in the next 2 to 5 years is just not that desirable. I think everybody will find a home. I'm not saying it's impossible, but they're just not as in high demand as the firms that are more better positioned, I should say.
Why the squeeze on mid-sized firms? Why are there fewer mid-sized firms than there used to be?
Well, this continuing trend of merger activity, which has been going on for, I would say, at least probably like 20 years. Many years ago, I used to put together a report that a lot of people may have seen called the deal sheet. And I used to report on all the deals that I could get my hands on, whether they were my deals or other people's deals. And there were, in the New York area alone, there could have been 20 to a year of firms merging up. And the reasons are the same as always. It's the aging partner group and the inability of having enough younger people to buy out the older partner group. So that is why the number of mid-sized firms has shrunk dramatically over the years. And by and large, most of the ones that are left are in, I would think, very good shape. They don't really have to consider a merge up or a private equity unless they really want to do that, because they tend to have enough of a dispersion of the partner group ages that they can create an internal succession plan, which is great.
What kind of firms are the bigger firms looking to acquire? Are they looking for smaller firms? Are they looking for mid-sized firms? Are they looking outside the business?
Well, the really big firms, private equity or not, are always looking outside the business also for related businesses that are not tax or attest related, but can fit into the group. For example, if a firm has a lot of real estate clients, they would love to, there's plenty of real estate advisory businesses out there or consulting firms or things like that. So those type of specialties. But the desire for growth is very intense, and that's probably a really big challenge for the mid-sized firms is growing their business, their traditional business, and growing the advisory business. You really need to have access to capital, and you really have to have an internal champion. There almost has to be a partner in charge of growth, which some of the big firms have people exactly with that title. And that's their job, M&A, seeking out other types of businesses to acquire, things like that.
You've said before that firms should be prepared in some very basic ways, such as having their financial information at hand, redacted client metrics, a list of top clients, and top industries. You say firms should be prepared. What do they need to have or do to be prepared?
Okay, well, I guess the best way I can answer that is you have to have a plan and accountability. And that's, I think, really hard for a lot of people and firms to do, which is a step-by-step outline or bullet points plan of all the different actions you need to take or have to take to be able to accomplish a certain goal with a timeline, with accountability, regular status reports. And there just has to be that serious level of commitment. And it really starts at the top. I mean, the firms I work with, and there's a number of them that are extremely successful, growing incredibly well organically and via merge-ins and things like that. They have created a culture. They talk about it all the time. They have a real plan and a real mission, and they're executing it. You know, maybe they make a little bit less money in the short term, probably do, but the results will speak for themselves over time.
At what point should a firm, whether they're a buyer or a seller, or trying to figure out whether they should be a buyer or a seller, at what point should they get professional advice? Who should they be engaging?
I would say as early as possible. There are plenty of consultants in the business, like myself and others, that can advise on a day-to-day basis the planning process for considering succession planning. Definitely engage an attorney, and ideally one that has got a lot of familiarity with the accounting industry. And you know, being active in the profession is another big part of it, which I've mentioned. Just a lot of people poo-poo spending time with the professional groups, and that's where you meet a lot of people as well. And I'd say a lot of these transactions happen without people like me involved, where they met somebody else or they know them from their hometown or something. And you have to be out there to be in the game.
Everybody's talking about private equity. We've been there before. Why is this time different?
Well, I don't think it's really different. I think that organically it has just become more pervasive. In other words, once a few private equity firms started focusing on the accounting profession, now there's a lot of them focused on the accounting profession. There's firms in New York and Chicago and the West Coast and Florida. There's private equity firms everywhere. And a lot of them have put accounting firms on the radar screen. So that's what's different about the past. But I do think the jury is still out in a big way as how it's going to play out because of the corporate ownership, the alternative structure. Will the incentive stock options or incentives for the non-founding partners and for the staff, all the talk about great upside in future liquidity events, will it all happen? Nobody really knows the answer to that question. And I think it's too early to tell. If I was a CPA firm and had a great practice and big enough to be of interest to the private equity companies, my thought process would be, I recently checked out electric cars with my wife and I got really, really intrigued with them. I thought they were the coolest thing, really fast, really quiet. And I was really ready to like sign on the dotted line. And then I decided, you know what? I think it's too early. I think it's like 2 or 3 years too early. I'm going to wait and see if this green movement and impetus to get rid of fossil fuels and all that, what happens with all that and see what happens. That's how I kind of feel about private equity. I mean, it's great right now for the founding partners in terms of liquidity. And it possibly could be very good for the firms, but I think it's just too soon to tell. That's my humble opinion.
20 and 30 years ago, we lived through acquisitions by American Express, H&R Block, Mayer, Hoffman & McCann, which became CBiz, McLadry. What went wrong? Why didn't that trend continue?
Yeah, from what I understand, I really believe the cultures just did not mesh and the expectations did not really come to pass. Why, you know, going back to your question too, why is this time going to be different? One thing I see, and if it happens, it will be great, but I don't know if it's going to happen or not, which is the private equities, on the one hand, hands off on the day-to-day operations, set your billing rates, do your hiring and firing, run your business like you always did. But besides having an open checkbook for acquisitions, which is really nice, the idea of helping the businesses. And from the conversations I've had, they talk about it. I don't know that they really have the expertise to do that. In other words, for a firm that's not already highly engaged in augmenting their staffing by outsourcing or having an office in India or the Philippines or Vietnam or whatever, or adopting artificial intelligence for compliance, tax compliance, especially, I don't know that they're really equipped, have the time, interest, or desire, meaning the private equity professionals, to get actively involved in helping the firms grow in those areas. I still think it's going to be up to the firms themselves, and some will be able to do it and some won't. I don't think private equity is going to have much of a difference there.
How does the corporate ownership affect the corporate culture and the sharing of profits in a private equity deal?
Well, I think it puts pressure on the profitability because as a 40 or 50% owner of the advisory and tax side of the business, they will expect and they will be getting a very significant return on their investment. And that means less profits for everybody else. So they have to make that up somewhere. Part of it they make up on what is well known in the private equity world and the accounting world as the scrape on partner compensation. The founding partners, the top equity partners, will take substantial reductions in their pay to create the EBITDA or the cash at closing type of thing. But I think this pressure on profitability and that kind of goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the feeling of pressure on the other partners and the staff group, pressure to produce, kind of filtering down because it's a limited limited pot of money to share.
What do you think people don't really understand about private equity deals? How does a deal work? What are the terms?
Well, typically they are the founding partners and the senior equity partners are typically getting 40 to 50 or maybe even higher percent of their deferred comp at the closing. They do take less compensation going forward for the remaining years they work. And there are various incentives for the rest of the partners that aren't getting the big bucks, so to say, at the closing, and the staff in terms of incentive options, stock options, formulas based on the growth of the practice from the time private equity comes in, annually or 6 months or whatever, based on the growth of the business. So there are a lot of incentives, and there's obviously the talk of the next liquidity event, because that is the essence of private equity, which is the 5 to 7 year hold period. Do what you can to help grow the business, build it up as much as you can. And then the idea is they're going to monetize it by selling it to another business. And that other business could be a larger accounting firm or a non-accounting firm. And to me, that is also one of the major, major question marks about private equity. Nobody knows what that's going to look like and how that's going to play out. If everybody makes millions, maybe everybody will be happy, but I always believe money doesn't buy happiness necessarily. So that's kind of remains to be seen. And you will find yourself working for another company in 5 to 7 years. Who is that going to be? Nobody knows. And nobody knows whether it'll be good or bad. So that uncertainty puts pressure on the staff and the staffing because, some people might be very excited by it and say, let me give it a year or two and see what happens. And others may go, this is not the direction I want to go. I want to go back to my original roots in a smaller to mid-sized firm where I'll be a bigger fish and go that direction. So a lot of unknowns.
You say partners get the big bucks. They're in on the deal. They're in the room when it happens. But staffers aren't. Staffers are not part of the deal. How does the deal affect staffers?
Well, people conjure up in their own minds what's really happening. And there's rumors flying around about this partner got this much money and this partner got that much money. And the firms, I'm quite sure, are doing town hall meetings, communicating extremely openly as much as possible about the new partner, the private equity deal, the alternative structure, the incentives going forward, the growth projections. The private equity firms and the CPA firms are doing a very good job of articulating the mission to the staff. But it's an unknown. It's new. And most people There's a certain degree of fear of change that we all have, and that uncertainty, you know, could lead people to think, you know, maybe this is not the right situation for me, potentially.
What should a staffer be considering when they're considering their career plans?
Well, that is a very loaded question there, Rick. I don't want to get into a debate or a conversation or an inappropriate conversation about values of different generations, because I'm sure my parents and their parents and their parents, they all said the same thing. Our world is more complicated. Our world works harder and blah, 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 all that. So I really don't have a magic elixir for that question.
Well, let's consider the most marketable staffers, the most senior staffers. How should they be considering their career plans these days in light of all the changes going on in accounting, including private equity? How do I make my career plans if I'm a 40-something staffer looking for a good, solid future?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a different way to frame the question, Rick, which I like. It is one of my absolute greatest pleasures to work with that staffer, whether they're new partner, senior manager, director, principal, whatever title, that is really dedicated to the profession, is passionate about public accounting, loves what they do, wants to make a career in the profession, and isn't sure where they are is the right place. This has got nothing to do with private equity or non-private equity in most cases. But as a long timer in the profession and a former practicing CPA myself, I love those conversations and those type of counseling and consulting, because, you know, I can talk very openly, honestly, and from firsthand experience about the benefits, the big firms, the mid-sized firms, and the small firms, and guide that person appropriately based on their objectives. Some people will be very, very happy in the biggest and best firms out there, others not. And it's, and there's, I think, a lot of misconception, because people come out of college, it's a whole different discussion, but in college, for the most part, the accounting majors hear a lot about the big four, the national firms, and other types of consulting companies. They don't hear much about small to mid-sized firms. Then they come out of college and they get turned off to the profession sometimes because the big firms, you know, may not be the best place to be, the nature of the work and so forth. And there's a whole other world of small and mid-sized firms. And sometimes they learn about them from friends, sometimes from people like me. But I really do like the role of being their advisor in that sense.
Let's say I'm a 40-something staffer who really isn't interested in becoming a partner at the firm I'm at now for one reason or another. I'd like to go out and be my own boss. I want to start my own firm. I've got a pretty good book of business. I'm not going to steal clients, but my clients know no clients that I can get. I've got a pretty good network. If I'm a 40-something staffer, how do I go out on my own and start my own practice? Should I start with an acquisition, or do I just hang up a shingle?
Well, you certainly can't hang up a shingle unless you have enough capital to support yourself for several years, because if you don't have a book of business, well, that person is probably earning now, to be specific, is probably earning between 150 and 250, depending on the firm size and their level and so forth. And they're probably on the younger side. They may have a spouse and they may have children and they may have a mortgage. And if they're living in New York, which is where we are, not cheap place to live. So if you're going to hang up a shingle, you better have $500,000 of business or better for sure, and be able to live on that. It's very hard to grow a practice. I'm sure nobody would disagree with one client at a time. That will take a very long time. And unless you're, you know, willing to accept more modest lifestyle, not the way people want to go. So to answer your question, I'm working with people like that currently, one in particular, and that has enough to hang out a shingle if they want to. They haven't done it yet, but they're very, very focused on acquiring smaller firms, one or two partner firms that don't have a succession plan. And that is the way to grow to a certain point. And then after a while, they may keep on doing acquisitions, or it may just feed on itself where clients continually refer new business. And because, you know, merging in practices is not easy at all. Is a whole cultural aspect of it, and, you know, merging in and fitting in, all, you know, melding them all together. But like I said earlier, there are definitely more entrepreneurial CPAs that I'm hearing about these days than I used to, which I think is great.
What's a more entrepreneurial CPA to do? What options do they have? Let's say they have a good bank account. They have enough to do almost anything they want to do, but maybe at a smaller scale. What's an entrepreneurial accountant to do these days in this market?
You mean, what are the steps they should take to grow their practice or set up their practice? What do you mean, Doug?
Well, let me put it this way. What steps should an entrepreneurial accountant take when they want to go out on their own and start by buying an existing practice?
Well, similar to what a firm should do when they want to take the step of figuring out their succession plan, whether it's merging up, merging with an equal, or bringing in a new partner, junior partner, it's really being able to articulate the plan, like their current business, being able to describe it in very clear terms, have good metrics about that, have a vision of what they want to do, what niches they want to get into, and what niches they want to grow, how they're going to do that by being active, like in, you know, trade associations or networking, things like that. It's really having a plan. And they really do need to work with people like me. I'm not the only one that does this, but, you know, it's like not a good thing to say these days because of the feeling about banks. But if you want money, you go to the bank. If you want to know about CPA firms that might be available for sale, you go to somebody that knows those kind of firms. And that's people like me. So I think it's very hard to do on your own. You can. I mean, that young person or that entrepreneurial CPA can go to tons of New York State Society or NICPAP meetings, breakfast meetings, networking meetings, technical meetings, and you can meet a lot of these practitioners that way. But you still have to establish a relationship with them. They're not going to volunteer just by saying hello. Oh, by the way, you know, you look young. You might be interested in buying my business. It doesn't happen that way. It really does have to happen organically. So
how can a outside facilitator, moderator, broker help that entrepreneurial accountant find a practice, find the right practice to buy, so they can go out on their own and they can start with a revenue stream?
Now, that's a great question. And I can only talk about how I go about doing things like that, which is similar to working with people on the recruiting and staffing side, which is very much understanding what they've done, what they've accomplished, what they want to do, what they bring to the table, and what's important to them, which, you know, varies from person to person. And then based on my knowledge, which is, you know, over many, many years now, of the accounting firms, small, medium, and large, and the geographic areas and the specialties, which one, two, or three might make sense to be a prospect. And I go about making those introductions, and I am their guide through the whole process, whether it's on the headhunting or recruiting side or the M&A side. I go to as many meetings, if not all the meetings, so that I'm very involved in the process. I just happen to take it incredibly seriously, as I should. But, you know, it's a process, and that's kind of what I do for a living.
Apparently it's working. Apparently your process has helped make you the leading broker and executive search executive in the very competitive New York metro market. What is your process? How do you first make contact with somebody, and how can they expect to work with you?
Well, most people that I work with, whether it's firms looking to merge or sell, or people looking to acquire practices, or people looking to change jobs, I would say my professional life, 90% of it is referral based, where somebody calls and goes, I got your name from so-and-so, can you help me? And then go about understanding what they do and what they're looking for, and go through that process with them. And I have, over the years, refined how I do things, and even, you know, provide them a roadmap, meaning a written document of, here are the different steps we're going to go through together, make sure we're kind of in sync about that, and have, you know, clear understanding about it. And it's a major deal to change jobs, to buy a firm, to sell a firm, to merge in with another firm, and it's life changing, and you know it just takes a lot of time and attention, and it's but I really happen to love what I do, and I love the public accounting profession. So to me, you know, it's not work; it's just something I really like to do.
Robert, what can firms do on the staffing side to improve recruiting and retention?
There are several specific ideas I have shared with many firms, and I will share with you today, that can help, because there's no simple solution. It's a finite group of people, and it's relationship based. But what can firms do on the recruiting side to maximize their chances? Here's several things. One is having good relationships with outside recruiters. Most firms have outside recruiters. They have their go-to people, whether it's one, two, or three different firms. But those relationships, to be effective, have to be cultivated. An outside recruiter is not going to give you that much attention if you are a small firm, let's say, and hire one person a year or two people a year, or very infrequently. You know, they're going to give their attention to the firms that hire, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 people a year. How do you get their attention? Well, one is by building the relationship. So I believe in the concept of meet the recruiter. Even if you've met them before, which a lot of people have never met them, but meet them in person. I'm talking about old school. Invite them to your office, go to their office, meet them, talk about why your firm is a great place to work, why young people or why people in general should consider your firm, and engage the owners. And if you can, ideally, engage the day-to-day recruiters that are going to be on the phone trying to recruit people for other firms. And you want to be at the top of the list. And the relationship is number one. Number two is kind of put your money where your mouth is. I'm a big believer in offering premium fees for short periods. If the normal recruiting fee is 20%, offer 30% or even 35% for a limited period of time. Maybe it's 30 days, maybe it's 60 days, whatever it is. Get their attention financially, make it more desirable if they can direct people that are interested in a firm like yours to them. And you can protect yourself on the downside by payment terms and by guarantee periods and things like that. Third thing is offer very high internal rewards to your people. If somebody refers a candidate that you, if you hired it through an outside recruiter, you're going to pay a $50,000 fee for. In my humble opinion, what's the big deal about giving your internal person $10,000, $15,000 if they recommend somebody? And, you know, typically you don't pay it day one. You might pay it 60 days after the person starts to make sure everybody's happy. But those are just three very quick ideas of how to do that. And I guess part B of that, that the firms I don't think most can do themselves, is social media. It's just the way to go. And I think if you can find a firm that can create a social media platform for your firm for recruiting, so you're all over Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn and Google and reviews and search engine optimization, you really got to do all those things to be out there. Okay. So those are my quick and dirty ways for firms to get the attention of the staff that they're looking to acquire and bring in.
Robert, thank you. It never hurts to talk. Thank you for today.
Right. You're quite welcome. Thank you, Rick.
If people want to get in touch with you, where can they find you?
You can find me on my website, but you can also find me probably easier by calling or texting me at my cell phone, which is 914-924-0963. That is probably the most efficient way to reach me. I don't mind the phone at all. Don't mind text. Certainly email. All are good.
Terrific.
Been a pleasure with you, and thank you, Rick. Great conversation.
Thank you. Until next time, this is Rick Kelbert for CPA Trendline.
Thank you for listening to the CPA Trendlines podcast, a production of CPATrendlines.com, now available on iTunes. We hope you'll rate and review us wherever you find your podcasts to help other accountants find our show more easily. For more information, you can go to CPATrendlines.com.